Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Roughly 300,000 patients in the United States get surgical site infections every year, and a new University of Utah study suggests that some of those infections are connected to a heritable genetic mutation. In the February 19, 2013, online edition of the journal Wound Repair and Regeneration, researchers from the University School of Medicine show through a study of families in the Utah population database that surgical site infections, SSIs, appear to have a significant genetic connection, even in extended relatives. Dr. Harriet Hoff, professor of anesthesiology at the University of Utah School of Medicine, co-author on the article, joins us to talk about the study. First, she describes the impact of the problem.
It's a little bit of a hard number to pin down exactly, but surgical site infections happen about 5% of operations overall. They're a huge problem that costs billions of dollars every year. They often make people either stay longer in the hospital or more often come back to the hospital because they usually show up somewhere between 4 and 7 days after surgery, sometimes as long as a month after surgery, and most patients are out of the hospital in a couple of days. So usually they happen at home, so they can mean readmission to the hospital. Sometimes they require one or more reoperations. In the example of, for example, hip replacement surgery, very few people get an infection, but if you get an infection, they often have to remove the hardware they put in, and it can take a year to kind of get yourself back to really being able to walk well and getting rid of the infection and getting the new hip replacement device in. So they cause a lot of cost. They keep people from going back to work. It's very hard to go back to work if you're doing dressing changes on an open wound. When someone gets a surgical site infection, normally what happens is you open the wound to drain the bacteria and then you let it close itself. Sometimes you'll go back in a few days and close it again. So it's a huge problem in the United States. And in fact, as evidence of how big a problem it is, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, which oversees health care for patients with Medicare and Medicaid, but they tend to drive policy, has something called the Surgical Complication, the Surgical Care Improvement Project, or SCIP. And there's a number of measures that they ask hospitals to do things right to make sure they try to prevent them. And a surprising number of those Surgical Care Improvement Project process interventions are related to preventing surgical site infection. So we measure, for example, are we keeping our patients warm? Do we give them antibiotics of the right kind and at the right time before their surgery? And there are whole guidelines on how to prevent surgical site infection, and we actually have a perioperative infection control committee, which we call Bug Busters, here at the University of Utah, which I co-chair with Kathy Adamson, who's one of our nurse administrators. And we meet, and our goal is to prevent surgical site infections. We have a two-page document that sort of says, here's all the things you need to do as an anesthesiologist, as a nurse, as a surgeon, to make sure your patient doesn't get an infection. You need to wash your hands, and you need to wear a hat and special clothes, and you need to keep your surface areas clean and give the antibiotics at the right time. So there's huge effort put into surgical site infection prevention.
It is important to take a step back here and find out what inspired Hoff to conduct this research. She grew up in New Hampshire.
I went to medical school at Dartmouth in my home state, and then I did actually a surgery internship at the University of Minnesota. At the end of my internship, I went out to University of California, San Francisco, to do a year of research with a surgeon there named Tom Hunt, who's was the founding president of the Wound Healing Society. We were interested in measuring oxygen in wounds, and that's what I learned how to do when I was there. And while I was there, I had a change of heart and decided I wanted to become an anesthesiologist, and I actually stayed at UCSF for 19 years and did my anesthesia residency there and then stayed on the faculty. And throughout my time there, I actually spent much of my time measuring oxygen in wounds and continuing to collaborate with Tom Hunt. When I arrived in the lab, we knew that there were a lot of wounds that had low oxygen levels and that raising them might make a difference. And it turns out anesthesiologists are the perfect people to manage how much blood is getting to people's wounds and whether they're getting enough oxygen during surgery. So that's how I kind of tied together being an anesthesiologist who studies surgical site infection.
And then can you describe how you actually manage that? Is it through oxygen levels, or how do you control that, how much oxygen?
The big thing that prevents, that makes wounds in general have less oxygen than they need, or is that you get constriction of the blood vessels in the wounds. And usually that's in response. Part of that is you, when you make a wound, you cut some of the blood vessels, so that causes a little bit of a problem. But a big part of it is the sympathetic nervous system, or the fight-or-flight response, which is or adrenaline. And adrenaline causes blood vessel constriction, particularly in the skin, with the idea that your heart and brain need more blood in an emergency than your skin does. But it turns out when there's a wound, it doesn't help it very much. And the things that set off the sympathetic nervous system fight-or-flight response are, generally speaking, major things that cause it: pain, being cold, being stressed or anxious, and being dehydrated. And if you think about patients having surgery, you're wearing nothing, so you're cold. The operating room is kept cold because the surgeons get too warm when they're operating. Surgery is often painful. Patients are not supposed to eat or drink anything the night before surgery, and then they can bleed, so being dehydrated is common. And most patients coming to the operating room are feeling very stressed. So the person who's in charge of all those things is actually the anesthesiologist. We give people anxiety-relieving medications. We give them fluids. We give them pain relief. We have the opportunity of keeping them warm. So one of the first big studies we did showed that when you keep patients who are having colon surgery warm, instead of allowing them to get cold in that cold environment, which is a side effect of anesthesia, you can actually reduce their rate of surgical site infection by about two-thirds. That was a big change. So we now keep patients warm in the operating room as a routine. It turns out that keeping them warm actually raises the amount of oxygen that gets to their wound. Now, once you have a patient who doesn't have a lot of fight-or-flight response and is well-perfused and good blood flow to their skin, if you give them extra oxygen, you can reduce their risk of infection as well. That's because the white cells use oxygen to kill bacteria, so it's part of host defense. But if you have someone who's cold and vasoconstricted, you can give them more oxygen, but it doesn't get there. So yes, giving oxygen can improve wound healing, or wound healing and resistance to infection, but only when you've taken care of the other stuff.
Oh, that's so interesting. And are there, what types of surgeries tend to lead to more infections? Or are there certain types that cause more infections than others?
There are. And there's sort of two factors that we think about. One is the wound getting contaminated? So that's why when you think about surgery, you think about the surgeons wear gowns and gloves and hats, and they wash their hands, and they wash the patient's skin, and they put drapes on. So they try to reduce the number of bacteria that are in the patient's wound. We also give antibiotics before surgery. And the other side is host defense. How well can your white cells kill bacteria? And it turns out both of them are very important. And I've been very, very interested in the host defense side of things. So the host defense side of things is really important. But when you think about wounds that tend to get infections, wounds that are contaminated, so wounds in the abdominal cavity, particularly wounds on the colon, because we know there are bacteria there to begin with, have a much higher rate of infection than, say, hip surgery. So when you're having colon surgery, the expected rate of infection is somewhere between 10 and 15% of patients will get a wound infection. If you're having hip replacement surgery or knee replacement surgery, the expected rate of infection is 1 to 2%.
Wow.
So clearly there's a big difference in that contamination level. At the same time, host defenses are important. We know that, for example, if you operate on a patient who's got diabetes, they have less good host defenses. Their white cells don't work as well, and they also often have decreased blood flow, particularly on their legs. They have a much higher risk of infection. On the other hand, when you operate on someone's face, they almost never get infected because there's such a great blood supply there. And the classic example of this is actually hemorrhoid surgery. So lots of people have hemorrhoids removed. It's hard to imagine a place more contaminated in the body than the rectum and where you're getting your hemorrhoids fixed. And those essentially never get infected because they have a huge blood supply. There's sort of those two factors: how much contamination is there and how good is the blood supply? And there's an interaction between the two, so that if you don't have a very good blood supply, you don't need very much contamination. If you've got a great blood supply, you can tolerate a lot of contamination. I think colon surgery is more contamination and pretty good blood supply, but not great blood supply, and that's why it's one of our favorite models, because it's got among the higher infection rates.
And then could you talk about your recent study and the gene that you suspect is associated with people who tend to get surgical site infections more than others, and there tends to be a correlation between relatedness?
Sure. So we actually don't know what gene it's related to. This is really a study that says, is there some genetic contribution? So when I got to the University of Utah 6.5 years ago, it seemed to me that given all I knew about host defenses, and there's been some studies that, for example, some people have a genetic susceptibility to getting a blood infection, getting sepsis, you know, and so that suggested to me that there are probably people who have susceptibility to getting a wound infection, and I could imagine which genes I think might be implicated, but I don't really know which ones they are. So I'd been thinking about this question for a while, and I came to the University of Utah, and I had a medical student, James Lee, who's the first author, who came to my office when he was a first-year medical student and said, I'd really like to do research with you. And I said, well, here's a problem I've been trying to address, and I know we have this Utah population database, but I don't know how to get in there. I'd like to know, are there some patients who are more likely to get infections than others based on their genetics? And he said, hey, well, I know Lisa Cannon Albright, and she's amazing, and she's got the Utah population database. I think we should collaborate with her. So he actually facilitated my talking to Lisa. And I don't. So the Utah population database is it's a database with 2 million people from a genealogical database from the LDS Church that was accessed in the 1970s that has great information in it, plus about somewhere between 5 and 7 million other records of people from Utah where there is less perfect genetic genealogical data, but where they're related to some people. So it gives you the opportunity to ask questions like, are there families that are more likely to have, for example, rotator cuff tears? And that was a study done by Robert Tashin and Lisa Cannon Albright a few years ago, and they showed that indeed there is some genetic component. So in our study, the Utah population database doesn't know the genetic makeup of any patients. It just knows what things have happened to them when they've been in the hospital. So that there's this genealogical database, and it's linked to healthcare records. And I can't go in and look at either the healthcare records or the database. It's because there's patient confidentiality issues. So what I can do is access it via Lisa and a computer program. And so in your healthcare record, your doctor says, here are the codes for what this patient had during this hospitalization or during this healthcare event. And everything is coded through something called the ICD-9, although I think now it's the ICD-10. So what we can do is we can say, find people who have the code for surgical site infection or something like surgical site infection. So the computer identifies this group of people, and in this case we found 651 people who had that diagnosis in their, or that group of diagnoses for surgical site infection in their healthcare record. And then what you do is you get a group of match controls who are matched by where they're from, sex and age, and you create 1,000 sets of people randomly taken from the database, 651 people who are matched to the 651 people who got surgical site infection, and you look and see if the people who got infection are more closely related to each other based on the information in the Utah population database than the people who didn't. And that's basically the fundamental finding we have, which is people who get surgical site infection are more related to each other than people who don't within that database and the healthcare records. So that doesn't tell us what gene it is or how it happened or anything. It just tells us that this is a good place to go look for a gene, that genes help determine whether you're going to get a wound infection.
And were you surprised by the results and how compelling that they were?
I would say I was more pleased. I have to say this was a belief I'd had for a long time that there must be a genetic component. I think I helped do a review article on the topic of monitoring in the future and got involved, interested in genomics and the contributions of genetics to wound healing around 2003. So this is something I've been wanting to answer for a long time and didn't know how to do it. And so I wasn't really surprised by the result, but I was very happy because, you know, you do something like this and you think, there are so many variables that could affect this. There's so many things that could confound our result that we might not find anything, even if there is a genetic contribution, because there are so many other contributors to surgical site infection: diabetes, smoking, obesity, the type of surgery they have, how long their surgery lasted, all kinds of things like that. I was worried that that would wash out the genetic effect. But the reality is it's actually a pretty strong marker, and it says, no, this is really real. So I was excited that we got that result because it means we can take another step. I don't think I was that surprised.
How could that change these procedures? And
yeah, so I would say I'm really excited about our findings, but it's a first step, and we have a long way to go. Because right now, I don't know what the genes are. I can imagine what genes they might be. They're genes that relate to how your white cells kill bacteria and how your defenses work against bacteria in your body, but I don't know which ones they are. So our next step, well, first our next step is to get funding, but then the step after that, which we're working on right now, but the step after that is we can actually access the families in the Utah population database. So there's a process for doing that within maintaining privacy and all that sort of thing. And it turns out in Utah, people tend to be pretty happy to come forward and have their blood drawn. And then we can draw their blood and do analysis of their genome in their blood to figure out, and basically you do comparisons of the genomes of a group of people, high risk and low risk, and say, what are the genes that are different between these populations and, you know, that might in some way affect whether they get surgical site infection. So now we'll identify. And my guess would be, the families, the genetic contribution isn't from a single gene. It's probably from multiple different genes, that so that we'll find that some people have a risk from one reason and some people have a risk from another reason. I think that will be fascinating. I don't know what we'll find. But so the example that we talk a little bit about in the paper, one of the primary ways, and I'm interested in it obviously because it has to do with oxygen, but one of the primary ways that white cells kill the bacteria that and prevent wound infection is by taking oxygen and converting it to oxidants, so things like hydrogen peroxide and bleach, which within the white cell kill the bacteria. And there is already a known genetic disorder called chronic granulomatous disease where the enzyme that converts oxygen into these other oxidants is defective. And patients with that disease get recurrent skin infections as one part of their disease. I'm going to say, I bet there's a mutation of that gene, which is called the FOX gene or the phagosomal oxidase, that makes it work less well, but not so badly that you have overt disease. And those are commonly seen in the world, sort of single gene mutations that make the enzyme just not work as well, but maybe it works okay. So if you find that that's a source of the problem, now you can start thinking about, okay, can we help boost the function of that enzyme? Can we make that enzyme work? What are the kinds of things that we could do that would replace the thing that's not happening in the body that would normally prevent infection? Or potentially we could find a gene that's overproducing something that makes bacteria happy, and then we could figure out how to make that gene stop doing it. So it's all a little pie in the sky right now that there's a lot of steps to take. We've got to figure out what the genes are, and then we've got to figure out what the genes are doing and then how to modify what the gene, you know, or what the defective, the mutated genes are doing, and then how to modify what those mutations do. And then the next step is, okay, if we figure it all out, now when a patient comes to the hospital to have surgery and I want to know if they're at high risk for infection, I actually have to know what their genome is. I have to know what their genetic makeup is. Do they have the normal kind of gene or the abnormal kind of gene? And that's not something that we know currently, although it's on the horizon. So the first human genome, so the genome of a single individual, was sequenced completely, so we know what all their genes are, in 2001, and it cost $100 million. Now you can sequence a human genome, and it took a long time. Now you can sequence a human genome pretty quickly for under $1,000. So I'm going to guess that by the time I can figure out what the genes are, patients are going to come to the hospital knowing their genome, so I'll be able to search their genome and find out if they have reason to believe they're at high risk for infection.
That's incredible. In the press release, this P47 gene mutation was identified. And is that, that's just, is that one you might suspect, or?
P47 is a piece of that. That's one of the things that goes wrong in these patients with chronic granulomatous disease.
In conclusion, Dr. Herod Hoff advises to look at the history of surgical infections and learn from the past.
The big thing that I'd like to say is, you know, at the time of the Civil War, it was very hard to do surgery because most people would die of infection. And then we figured out things like washing our hands and washing the skin, and then antibiotic prophylaxis came in the 1970s. and really reduced infection rates. And all of it was very focused on reducing contamination that's coming to the skin, and very little of it was focused on the patient's own host defense. And I think one of the reasons that we still have an infection rate around 5% is that we need to focus more on host defenses, and that's really been the area I'm interested in. And I think when we look at the genetics of the person, that's really getting right down to how good are their host defenses, and if we can beef up host defenses, we know that some contamination that happens may become less and less important, and I think that'll be the next big step in reducing surgical site infection. I'm not sure we can ever eliminate it completely, but, you know, this idea of being able to boost the immune system of the patient having surgery is likely to be the next big step that we can take to help get rid of surgical site infection after we've done a whole lot of work on preventing contamination.
That was Dr. Harriet Hoff. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Long before these crowded streets, here stood my dreaming tree. Below it he would sit for hours at a time. Now progress takes away what forever took to find. And now is falling hard, he feels the falling dark. How it longs to be beneath this dreaming tree. Conquered fear to climb, a moment frozen time, when the girl who first he kissed promised him she'd be his. Remembered mother's words there beneath the tree. No matter what the world, you'll always be my babe.
Dr. Zorba Pastor from Zorba Pastor On Your Health is coming to Utah. Dr. Pastor will give a free presentation titled Three Simple Steps to Ultimate Health on Friday, October 18th at Moab Regional Hospital. His address will be followed by a reception. Space is limited, so go to upr.org for registration information. Zorba Pastor will headline other events in Moab and Logan. You can find out more about those at upr.org. And Zorba Pastor's visit in Moab is sponsored by USU Moab and Moab Regional Hospital.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crum Brothers Artisan Bread. At 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2. With a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
In the modern day, where the Western diet has led to epidemics of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease, a group of researchers are revisiting a Stone Age recipe that has us eating like cavemen, restricted to animal protein and plants. No grains, legumes, dairy products, and certainly nothing processed. Basically, if early humans didn't eat it, you shouldn't either.
When you talk about the word paleo, it evokes Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble.
Lauren Cordain is professor of health and exercise science at Colorado State University and considered founder of the primal health movement called the Paleo Diet, named after the Paleolithic era beginning roughly 2.5 million years ago and ending about 10,000 years ago. This popular modern version seeks to mimic the diet of pre-agricultural hunter-gatherers.
I don't expect that everybody in the world is going to understand this concept or even have heard of it. This is an eclectic concept that has evolved from nutritionists, from anthropologists, and physicians. So the concept has become very, very big, and in the scientific literature, it's just starting to emerge.
The diet is sparking controversy and curiosity, as well as attracting converts across the world. Cordain and the Paleo Diet have become so popular, he gets upwards of 300,000 hits a day on Google, second only to another famous professor with an office down the hall, Temple Grandin, whom you might remember redesigned livestock slaughterhouses for the more humane treatment of cattle. It is always surprising to a scientist when their work goes viral.
I never really set out to become the world's expert. I was very selfish. I just wanted to find out what the best diet was for me on a personal level. And so that was really my motivation. I would do this whether I were famous or got published or wrote books or not. It's my passion.
Cordain was a popular attendee at the first ever Ancestral Health Symposium at UCLA, featuring the latest research on the Paleolithic diet. He described it as the Woodstock of evolutionary medicine. Aside from the presenting scientists, about 300 people showed, many of which were Western yogis and fitness gurus. It was LA, after all. This new research suggests hunter and gatherers were healthier than the ancient farmers who began to eat processed grain about 10 to 15,000 years ago, according to the archaeological record. One of the most well-known anthropologists studying this is Mark Nathan Cohen, also at the symposium, and who has been a great influence on Cordain.
He was able to show that if you look at the skeletal remains of hunter-gatherers, and then just as they made the transition to early farmers, their skeletons showed that they were very unhealthy, they were shorter, they lost on average 5 to 6 inches, they developed bone mineral problems and other pathologies that can be inferred from diet. So part of the problem is that they went from eating tremendous diversity of wild plant and animal foods to eating staples like cereal grains, which are nutritional lightweights compared to wild plant and animal foods.
The most problematic of the cereal grains is wheat, according to Cordain, and what was once called the USDA food pyramid is now called MyPlate. And this program recommends 6 servings of grains per day. Half should be whole grains.
That is a very poor recommendation for 1% of the population who has celiac disease. And so eating wheat causes symptoms in celiac patients. So 1% of the population may not sound like much, but we have 300 million people in the U.S., so it turns out to be a substantial number. And even more importantly, what we're finding now is gluten sensitivity. Besides paleo, the other really hot topic in diet is gluten-free. And so it turns out about 20% of the U.S. population has gluten sensitivity, meaning that they have a variety of symptoms and illnesses when they eat wheat. And so that's why the gluten-free products have exploded across the United States and actually worldwide. Cereal grains not only are responsible for celiac disease, but we also suspect that they're responsible for a variety of other autoimmune diseases because they contain a substance that increases intestinal permeability. And it does so not just in celiac, but in so-called normals as well. So, and the other issue with grains that I have is that they're nutritional lightweights. If you compare them on a calorie-by-calorie basis to either fresh fruits, vegetables, lean meats, or seafood, they come in last. And so I, for the life of me, can't understand, except that they're cheap, why our government is, through its My Plate program, is promoting the consumption of a food that produces nutritional deficiencies and can cause actual ill health in many people.
75% of people in the U.S. have one or more symptoms of either type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or hypertension, basically high blood cholesterol, and high triglycerides. Cordain's research shows, too, that certain types of cancer, epithelial cell cancers like breast, colon, and prostate cancer, are linked to diet. All of these ailments are components of the metabolic syndrome, says Cordain.
Anecdotally, what we find is that people with the metabolic syndrome, their symptoms seem to fade away. Hypertension, dyslipidemia, all of these characteristic symptoms of insulin resistance fade away on the paleo diet. And one of the most thrilling factors that has come about in the last 10 years since people have been doing this is that people with autoimmune disease seem to improve and even go into complete remission. So diseases that at one time were thought to be completely non-controllable have shown some really good effects with paleo diets. And so that's what we're doing right now. My graduate students and I, we've got an ongoing study, and it's a large case study in which we have close to 100 people with autoimmune disease that have gone into either complete remission or partial remission from following this. And so we have their personal medical records that we are compiling. And so this is one of the thrilling parts of this. And so we think that, as I mentioned earlier, is that wheat is very problematic in autoimmune disease because it causes a leaky gut in many people. And we think that that's one of the triggering factors in genetically susceptible people with autoimmune disease is their if their intestines become leaky. And so, you know, wheat is people like to eat sandwiches and crackers and cookies and bagels and cereal and this for breakfast and whatever. So there's a behavioral component to it, but there are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people that have adopted the paleo diet worldwide, and I don't think that they have a problem. To me, a slice of bread or versus a bowl of fresh blackberries, there's no comparison. I'd much rather eat a bowl of fresh blackberries any day than eating a piece of bread.
Cordain has done extensive and well-respected research on hunter-gatherer diets. One of his more well-known studies looked at their diet and acne. To determine whether hunter-gatherers suffered from acne, Cordain teamed up with husband and wife anthropology duo Kim Hill and Magdalena Hurtado, who are famous in the field for their longtime research of about 30 years on one of the last remaining hunter-gatherer groups, living in the Paraguay forest, the Aché. This is the sound of Aché elders performing one of their traditional songs around a small campfire. Kim Hill introduced me to them in 2006. I had the rare fortune to spend several weeks living with the Aché, deep in the remote Atlantic rainforest, experiencing the hunter-gatherer diet firsthand, complete with fox, rodents, armadillo, nuts, berries, even monkey brains and insect larvae, larvae the size of stuffed green olives, that I ate roasted like a marshmallow dripping off a stick. Diseases such as obesity and diabetes are quite new to this society and are not uncommon. The traditional Aché diet also prevented acne. During the course of Hill and Hurtado's 2-year acne study, they did not find a single case of acne among the Aché, nor did Cordain among the Catawban Islanders.
They live in this island in the South Pacific off the coast of Papua New Guinea, and there's about 3,000 of them, and there was 250 to 300 teenagers in that group. And once again, not a single teenager or person in the population had acne. And so we suggested in a paper in 2002 in the Archives of Dermatology that indeed it was their diet that was common to both the Aché in Paraguay and the Catawbans that prevented them from developing acne, even in their teenagers. If you were to round up 300 teenagers in the United States, about 85 to 90% of them would have acne. So we didn't find a single case. And then really the proof of the pudding, I wrote a couple more papers mechanistically on how we believe diet actually caused acne and was invited to some prestigious international conferences to present our work. And the proof of the pudding was in 2006, a paper was published by my colleague Neil Mann from Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, and they actually put a group of adolescents with acne on a diet that mimicked certain characteristics of hunter-gatherer diets, and lo and behold, the acne went away.
There are two suspects, the high glycemic load and a popular dairy product.
Milk does a number of things. It also spikes insulin levels, but it contains hormones that many people, including the research group at Harvard, believe is responsible for acne because they think that the hormones in cow's milk cross the gut barrier and influence our own hormones. So it comes down to Western diet, and hunter-gatherers don't drink milk or eat dairy products, and they don't have processed foods, so their diet tends to have a low glycemic load generally.
Craig Stanford, professor of biology and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, also attended the Ancestral Health Symposium at UCLA to present on the meat-eating behaviors of wild chimpanzees and on the meat-eating habits of our ancestors. At the conference, Stanford was the lonely skeptic, admonishing the paleo dieters that revisiting this Paleolithic era isn't a blanket solution.
Laurent Cordain is a great scholar, and he did some great work about 10 years ago looking at the diets of different hunter-gatherer groups in the world, and he found that they had pretty similar intake of protein and fiber and so forth. But nevertheless, you know, I think most scholars would say that the human diet, there's no single monolithic human diet, and when people approach their own personal lives and their own personal diet and health in that simplistic a way, then, you know, they're bound to to either fail or just eat something that's unnecessary for them to eat.
I think that the paleo diet sometimes has been criticized because it eliminates two food groups. It eliminates grains and dairy, but in the same manner, the food pyramid or the My Plate recommends that you can eat a nutritionally adequate vegan diet. Well, a vegan diet also excludes at least two food groups. It excludes dairy and it excludes meat. And that is, to my way of thinking, a really unhealthy diet is a vegan type diet.
I think the idea that eating a lot of lean meat is perfectly fine, which is something that paleo dieters would advocate, I think there's a mountain of medical evidence that links meat to all sorts of ailments, including cancers. And it's really indisputable. And there are books out there arguing against that, I know. But the mountain of evidence is that, if you want to really enhance your health, if you want to ward off cancer potentially, then being a vegan, for instance, is a very, very healthy way to live. And that's something that, when I was at the conference at UCLA, in fact, some of the speakers would joke about veganism and vegetarianism. They'd raise that as a kind of a practical joke topic, and the audience would cheer and jeer. And I just thought that was kind of bizarre, given what we know about the value of eating a plant-based diet. The problem with eating meat or eating eggs is not just eating them by themselves. The problem is that in our modern world, you can go to the market and you can buy and eat eggs and meat and so forth in bizarrely huge quantities compared to what our ancestors did. So to be a paleo diet advocate and say, well, eating lean grass-fed beef is a really great thing, it should be in everybody's diet, that might be fine, but you have to remember that foraging people, most foraging people, traditionally, historically, have only been able to get meat fairly rarely. And so they're living on a pretty low protein diet for the most part. And that's something that we forget when we say, oh, yeah, let's practice a paleo diet. We also forget when we go to the market and buy eggs that ancient people only could get eggs for a few weeks every spring. So they would gorge on eggs, and they wouldn't suffer any cholesterol or heart issues because then the eggs weren't laid anymore. The wild birds stopped nesting, and there weren't any eggs until the following spring. Of course, now we have eggs whenever we want them, and that's really the problem. My own feeling, just based on chatting with paleo diet advocates, is that there are a lot of folks in the paleo diet movement who simply love beef, and they really want to find a rationale that allows them to go out and grill their steak. And this offers them that rationale, and they believe in eating lean meat, and they believe in not eating it too often. But I think that to some extent, it's driven not just by science, as is the case for every diet out there. It's not driven just by science. It's driven by what people want to do when they fit the science into their belief system and into their particular palate and what they like to eat. You know, I'm not a medical researcher, but all I can say is that when you look at the literature that's out there, you can find hundreds of studies advocating a plant-based diet. And you can also find studies advocating a diet that's not so strongly plant-based. You can find diets like the paleo diet that advocate eating plenty of lean meat and so forth. So there are hundreds of studies out there. And, of course, people come along and say, my new study disproves the earlier ones. And all we can say today, if you want to take a rational approach, is that the preponderance of evidence, the mountain of evidence today, is that a plant-based diet is the healthiest diet.
Though Stanford is clearly not a big fan of the paleo diet, he and Cordain see eye to eye when it comes to curbing the American propensity to gorge on bad food.
In America, we're suffering not diseases of underconsumption, we're suffering from diseases of overconsumption. Two-thirds of the population is obese or overweight, and so most middle-class Americans can afford to eat whatever they like, and those are the people that are unfortunately sick and overweight and have diseases of insulin resistance, so they certainly could make changes by making dietary changes. And I think health care costs could be significantly reduced if people uniformly adopted a diet that was composed of fresh fruits and vegetables and lean meats, and they avoided processed foods.
There's a kernel of truth there that's really valuable, which is that we should be avoiding processed foods, and we should be avoiding a lot of the junk and the extreme caloric intake that we put in our bodies these days. However, these people who go around promoting the paleo diet, I believe, as somebody who studies human evolution, take an extremely simplistic view of what early humans were all about and what their diets were all about. So, for instance, just the idea that there is a natural, single, ancient human diet is silly. So if you ask a paleo diet advocate or scholar about what that really means, they'll say, well, it means whatever people were eating before agriculture and before livestock is what we ought to be eating today. So no dairy, no grains, no breads, etc. But of course, we really don't know exactly what time period we're going to talk about if we try to nail down when the, quote, natural diet happened. Was it 10,000 years ago before agriculture began? Was it 100,000 years ago? Was it 500,000 or a million years ago? At each stage of the human evolutionary scope, there would have been variable diets. People were eating different things. If you looked at people living on the seacoast versus people living in the forest or in the mountains, of course, they would be eating very different diets. So when people say you should be eating a paleo diet, my response is, which paleo diet are you talking about? And how many paleo diets were there? And which time period and which species of early human are we trying to base our dietary recommendations on?
For Cordain, sticking to a diet of lean meat, vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds, no matter how you slice it, produces healthy results.
My wife and I have been doing this probably longer than anybody on the planet except for hunter-gatherers. We were doing it since the early 90s. At the time when I first adopted it, I was in my late 30s and I was a runner, and I noticed that my endurance seemed to increase and muscle tone. And my wife is a triathlete. She also noticed a lot of therapeutic effects. And I think that you have to be open-minded and look at the facts. When I say that the paleo diet is more nutritionally dense than any diet out there, whether it's the food pyramid, my plate, the Mediterranean diet, Japanese diet, it's a much more nutrient-dense diet. And we've published two papers on that in the scientific literature. Anybody can look at the data.
Here's the problem with any of these diets, whether we're talking about paleo diet, veganism, Atkins diet, South Beach diet, you name it, is there's a certain level of irrationality that goes into the diets that people choose. If you want to stick to a healthy diet, then you have to take rational approaches. And when it becomes a religion for you, when you say, well, I'm a vegan, so I never eat this, or I never eat that, or I'm a paleo dieter, so I only eat this or that, well, that becomes a little bit irrational. I mean, I live in Southern California. I go out every day driving, and I see people, running along the side of a freeway where they're inhaling polluted air, which is terrible for them. They've increased their respiratory rate by running, and then they're taking in more pollutants. And then they go home, and they start obsessing about the diet that they're eating. So we all take kind of an irrational approach. We kind of create a private little theory about what's best for us. And I use the term, we're 7 billion nutritionists in the world today. We all have our reasons, whether they're religious, family tradition, or something we've read, that we should eat a certain way. And of course, it's easy to take it beyond the point of rationality. What I recommend is eating a rational diet. And what I mean by that is, don't get religious about, I don't believe in being religious about anything in life, including religion. So don't get religious about what you eat. Don't think, I can't eat this, I can't eat that. It kind of goes back to your grandmother's advice of eating a balanced diet. If you eat a balanced diet and you avoid processed foods, that's something we should avoid. We should avoid all of these foods that are packed with sugars and chemicals and so forth to kind of addict us to buy more. If you avoid those kinds of foods, then you're going to be fine. And, we're evolved to be a very, very plastic species. We're a generalist species in terms of our diet. We live in all sorts of different habitats historically. We do just fine in all those different places. And so people were eating a varied diet as far back as we can find in the fossil record.
I really don't know why this concept is controversial, because it's factual. It has nothing to do with me or anybody else. It's just look at the data and see how it plies out. So that's the frustrating part, is that, when you have a correct answer to a complex diet health-related question, it should be considered.
There are plenty of foods out there that when paleo dieters say, don't eat so much dairy, don't eat so much grain, that they've got a good point. These are not foods that we evolved to eat. Just as cows did not evolve to eat corn, and when you feed it to them in large quantities in these feedlots, they get really sick and need antibiotic treatment. And that's what grass-fed beef is supposed to avoid. In the same way, we shouldn't be eating a lot of the foods that we eat. You do have to remember one thing, which is that historically, evolutionarily, humans evolved to live long enough to reproduce, and then a little bit more than that. We didn't evolve to live to be 80 or 90 years old. Most of the diseases that affect us that are diet-caused whether it's heart disease or cancer, they hit us mainly after we're done reproducing, when we're in our 60s, 70s, and beyond. So from an evolutionary standpoint, humans can eat practically any diet at all, and they can do just fine. And in Darwinian terms, the name of the game is surviving to maturity, reproducing successfully, and then whatever happens beyond that is just icing. So in a sense, I think the fuss over what you're eating is really misplaced, because we didn't, as a species, evolve to eat a particular diet with the goal of living to be 80 or 90. Today, that's our goal. And that's really a goal that is way beyond the realm of natural selection, because it's all happened so recently that we're actually thinking about living to be 90 years old. Historically, we just didn't. It wasn't an issue.
Since we are living beyond our years, it's certainly not a bad idea to eat well. For myself, that means eating paleo at least on weekdays. So far, I have not regretted it. And according to Lauren Cordain, once you try it, you never go back.
I just think that people ought to give it a try and do it for 2 weeks, see how you feel. Most people feel so rotten after if they go paleo for 2 weeks and then they say, I'm just craving a donut. And they go out and they eat a donut. It makes them feel so bad they don't want to do it again. I think that's one reason why people stick with it, is that they feel so good.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.
I tell you this, I think that I started getting hate email the next day. I got up and said, well, you want me to add something else here? This is funny. You want to record this and we'll do one other little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. So I gave this talk at UCLA, and I got up and pointed out that when paleo dieters say you should go to the market and you should live out of the produce section and the meat section and avoid the other parts of the market. And I pointed out that if you look at what wild chimpanzees eat, they're eating a very high fruit diet, and yet their fruits that we would never call them sweet. You'd have trouble getting it past your lips because they are not sweet. You'd probably throw up if you tried to eat them. And in the same way, the foods that we buy in the market, when you go to the market and buy kale or Brussels sprouts or broccoli, those foods do not resemble nutritionally their ancestors, that our ancestors were eating, because they're packed with sugar these days. Farmers know that people like to eat sweet, tasty greens. And so even greens that don't seem sweet to us, let's say kale, are intensely sweet compared to their ancestors. And I gave this talk at the Paleo Diet Conference, and people got very upset because I think they felt that when they go to the market and buy greens, they're basically replacing an ancient diet with a modern diet that's very equivalent, and it simply is not.
Oh, my gosh.
So there you go, yeah. But I got hate mail saying I was totally wrong and yada, yada, and then I went and asked colleagues of mine who do nutrition whether I was right or not. And they also, of course, these modern plants, you know, look at corn. Corn was like, you know, about an inch long, its ancestors, right? Now it's this big, sweet, tender thing, and they just don't resemble their ancestors. So obviously the paleo dieter is advocating a diet that's way healthier than those people who are out there eating just junk food.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the Utah artist considered to be among the top women American artists, teacher, dancer, rancher, and tenacious painter, Minerva Tykert. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Artist Minerva Kohlhepp Tykert was born in North Ogden, Utah in 1888. Throughout her life, she captured on canvas the great Mormon pioneer story and the story of the American West.
Minerva grew up in a large family on a remote ranch in Idaho. Her mother was the daughter of one of Brigham Young's bodyguards, and her father had been disowned by his prominent family when he joined the LDS Church. The religious and pioneer stories told by her parents inspired Minerva's art all her life. Though women artists were not common in the West during this time, there is no doubt that the young Minerva got an early start to her career. When she was 4 years old, her mother gave her a set of watercolors, and from then on, Minerva considered herself an artist. She carried sketch pad and charcoal with her constantly, a practice she maintained into adulthood. As a young woman, Minerva taught school to save money to attend the Art Institute of Chicago and was the first woman to be sent for art lessons with the official blessing of the LDS Church. She later received a scholarship to study at the Art Students League in New York City, one of the most important art centers in the world. To pay her way, she sketched cadavers for medical schools, illustrated children's books, painted portraits, and performed rope tricks and Indian dances on the New York stage. Minerva turned down opportunities to further her career in the East and instead returned home to paint the history of the Mormon people. She married cowboy Herman Tykert and with him ran their ranch and raised their 5 children. Somehow, she also painted. Her studio was their living room, which was too small for her large works, so she folded her murals as she painted and, to get the correct perspective, viewed her canvases through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars. Her children were sent to bed at 8 o'clock each night so she could paint until midnight. Tykert produced prolifically, painting more pioneer and Indian subjects than any other Utah artist. Women and Western themes feature prominently in her work, and she is noted for a series of murals depicting the scenes from the Book of Mormon. Her aim was to produce works of art that would motivate people, in her words, to build Zion. She created more than 60 murals that adorn public places in Utah, and her work is in museum collections throughout the state. Minerva Tykert died in 1976 in Provo, Utah. Content for this episode of the Beehive Archive was provided by the Springville Museum of Art. Sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
On From the Top, we don't just put young people on the show to hear their incredible musical performances. We celebrate the whole kid.
We're all members of the Vermont Astronomical Society, and we've also gotten really into building telescopes.
I run cross country, and I run track.
Well, I'll eat anything as long as it's not looking at me and as long as it's not moving around.
I believe the correct term is math stud.
Join me, Christopher O'Reilly, to meet America's most outstanding young musicians on From the Top, each week from NPR.
Friday afternoons at 2, repeated Sunday nights at 9, on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you by USU Partners in Business 37th Annual Accounting Conference, October 24th, at the USU Eccles Conference Center, featuring keynote speaker, investment banker Frank K. Casey, Lessons from the Madoff Fraud. Details at partners.usu.edu.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.